know how to mine now.
Me too. All right, like I said last week, I'm going to try to start on time and end on time every week. So I'm going to start right now. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers. My sobriety date is February 18, 2002. I'm a member of the Central Orlando Group, and I am in love with the Eufaula Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where I am today. Let's start this meeting like we normally do with a moment of silence, and we'll follow it with the Serenity Prayer. Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the thing I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right. Last week we went over some of the history and how these guys got together to stay sober one day at a time, and then they decided they needed to write a book. And so they wrote the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It was named after a group that had started out in Cleveland. And the book has a couple of things, and I want to just go over them real quick. It's a book, a textbook, okay? And so we're supposed to do what with a textbook? We're supposed to study it and refer back to it. And I'm going to go back to the very first edition, because it's going to tell us exactly what directions we're supposed to find. And it says right there that we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further no further proof would be necessary. There are some words I just can't get at sometimes. And on page 20 it says, if you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? Well, it's the purpose of the book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. And then on page 29 it says, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. Now, they use that word recovered many times in the book. And I said last week, it simply means to get well. And the purpose and the object of the book, and I'm gonna jump around a little bit before I start the doctor's opinion. On page 20 it says, if you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may be already asking myself, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. And on page 45 it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. It does not say your alcohol problem, it says your problem. The hope that this book gives everyone to recover is to get well. And on page 98, when you're working with others, it says, burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well, regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trusts in God and clean house. Now, Dr. Bob kept this program real simple. And the simplicity that Dr. Bob used comes pretty much at the beginning of A Vision for You. Where it says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God, clear away the wreckage of your past, give freely what you find. That right there is trust God, clean house, help others. And that's how Bob wanted to keep the program as simple as possible for all of us. So we know it's a textbook, and what we're going to find out from the doctor's opinion and when we get into Bill's story is that they're going to continually tell us about the problem and the solution. The problem and the solution. Okay? Problem is step one, solution is step two. And they're going to do that for 60 pages. because Bill talks more about step one than he talks about any other step in the book. And the reason he does that is because it goes against every one of us, especially me, Grain, to admit that I am powerless. That's why so many people die, because they just won't admit to their powerlessness and then accept that there's a solution to their problem. All right, we'll start with the doctor's opinion now. There was a gentleman who brought a first edition big book last week, and it was really cool to see that. But what happened in the first edition, when Dr. Silkworth gave this letter, they started it on page one with Dr. Silkworth, and he didn't sign the letter because it's an opinion. It wasn't proven by facts. By 1955, when they printed the second edition of the big book, GSO moved the doctor's opinion to the Roman numerals in all the other editions, because most people start reading a book on page one, and they didn't want a non-alcoholic to start on page one. They wanted Bill's story to start on page one, and so every other book after that starts on page one. But we know, as a textbook, you got to read it from the front cover to the back cover, and especially the doctor's opinion through the first 164 pages. That's where we're going to find the program of recovery as outlined by the first 100. And then, you know, if I don't agree with it, I can say, you know, I don't agree with it. And my sponsor is really quick to say, well, 2.5 million people have recovered because of it, and you don't agree with it. Which do you think is stronger? And I would think that the 2.5 million is much stronger than me. He didn't even put his name in the first edition, because, like I said, it was just his opinion. But when they printed the second edition, and the American Medical Society at that time finally agreed that it was a disease, it was an illness, the Psychiatric Society agreed it was an illness, Dr. Silkworth said, yes, you can use my name now. And, you know, it had been proven in that 13-year period. Okay. Let's see. And you see me, I'm going to be using notes all afternoon. All right. The doctor's opinion. It starts off with, and remember that the big writing is alcoholics, the small writing is going to be the doctors. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Now, the plan of the recovery is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is what the plan of recovery is. And it's described in this book in great detail. Convincing testimony must surely come from the medical men who had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcohol and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. This was the first letter he gave. And it said, to whom it may concern, he specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of the type I had come to regard as hopeless. No hope. That's hopeless. There is just, you know, helpless and hopeless. And that's what we're hoping to recover from. And he goes on, and that's Bill Wilson he's talking about. Let me see if I have it marked. And he talks about hopeless again. On page 43, it says, the doctor's talking again, and it says, as the two of you men whose stories I have heard, there's no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless, apart from divine help, which is going to be step two. It says, in the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain... And y'all are going to just have to bear with me. I'm going to jump ahead, and I'm going to jump back, because that's the only way I know how to do this. In the course of the third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning the possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. Now, I don't know if anybody's ever told you there are no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to find the word must over 100 times in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a suggested program, I was told when I came in. Well, it suggested you pull the ripcord if you jump out of an airplane with a parachute, right? So I'm either going to do this or I'm going to die. So what they're saying right there is impressing upon them, the ones he's working with, that they have to do likewise with still others. They must. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. The man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Now, recovered, fourth time it's used so far in the book. And he goes on to say that he's known scores of cases who were the type of with whom other methods had failed completely. Dr. Silkworth worked with over 50,000 alcoholics. And he had worked with about 25,000 before this program started. And he had about a 3 or 4% success rate. People just were able to quit. But after that, the success rate was, we went through it earlier, it was somewhere around 75%. That was in one of the fours. On the next page, right before his signature, it says, "You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves." Not about Jonathan, not about you, not about him, not about her, about me. You can rely on when I tell you what I've done. Now, the alcoholics go on to say that the physician who at our request gave us this letter, he's been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. And it did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. Now, through the first 40-something pages, you're going to hear that this is a twofold illness, an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. Okay? And then it's going to take you to a threefold illness a little bit later on. And the twofold illness right now is the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion to his soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, altruistic is other-centered, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he's approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. What did he just say? He just said, Bill just said, that before you can really understand anything, you need to detox. You know, and detox centers back in his time were not hospitals, and there weren't one on every corner. They were sanitariums. That's where you went. The detox. Hospitals didn't want alcoholics. They didn't think we were sick. They just thought we were drunks and they didn't want to have anything to do with us, and so we were put in sanitariums, and that's where Bill was. He was in the sanitarium part of the town's hospital up there. Now, the doctor's getting ready to write a second letter where he goes on to explain more. And where this letter comes into play, it's my understanding, and a lot of this is my understanding, and if you can prove me wrong, tell me afterwards. Please don't shout it out. But they have written a book. They have written a manuscript. And Bill felt it imperative to send that manuscript out to about 200, 250 people. Clergymen, psychiatrists, medical doctors, church elders, because he didn't want to publish anything that he thought might be offensive to religion or medicine. And so he sent out all these copies, and one of his friends was a medical doctor, and he said, "You need to start the book with somebody who has a knowledge in the medical field." And so he went back to Dr. Silkworth, who had been treating him for these three different times he had been in there, and he asked him to write a letter to go to the front of the book. Because if you all remember the history, when Bill got sober and he started running around to the bars and the Boweries, what was he doing? He was preaching. He was talking about his spiritual awakening, his spiritual experience, and after 6 months, not one person stayed sober, and he went back to Silkworth, and Silkworth said, you got to hit him with the medical facts first about the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body before you bring in the spirituality, or you're going to chase everybody off. And so that's why they have the doctor's opinion first, explaining the twofold disease, and then Bill's talking about the problem and the solution, the problem and the solution, the problem and the solution. Now it says a couple lines down, we doctors, now it's Dr. Silkworth talking about medical experts, have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. He's talking about doctors and psychiatrists. What with our ultra-modern standards, this is 1939, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. And what's he talking about? He's talking about God. He's talking about God. The doctors have a way of cutting you and taking out a problem or giving you a pill to fix a problem. Okay? But they are not schooled or skilled in spirituality. And what he was just saying, what he was trying not to say, but what he just said was that they aren't equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside their synthetic knowledge. So many years ago, one of the leading contributors of this book came under our care in the hospital. He's talking about Bill. And while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into a practical application at once. Okay? You all heard me talk about last week the words immediate, following, don't delay, at once. This is not a program to be danced around with. This is a program to be done. This is a program of action. And so when you get done with one step, you don't just sit on it and hang around for a while and think about it. You move on to the next step. Because the whole goal of this book is to get us to that 12th step, to get us into a spiritual experience, and to get us to carry the message. That's the goal. All right? Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgivings, we consented. The cases we have followed, though, have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, that we come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Now, they talk about chronic alcoholics. Not everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous is a real alcoholic. They talk about real alcoholics and they talk about chronic alcoholics. Chronic is a condition that never goes away. Okay? We have a lot of heavy drinkers that come into AA. We have people that come in just to get a paper signed. We have people that come in and they read the book and then they have a program and they talk about their program, and what they're doing is watering down the program of action, the recovery program that's in this big book right here. Now, like I said, chronic and hopeless, those are two words that I really didn't like, but I'm one. I was going to turn the page, but I'm not now. Let me go back to that page. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. Now, Dr. Bob went to 6 drying out farms, and every time he came out of a drying out farm, he was in the Oxford group, going there with Ann for 2.5 years, drinking. He went to 6 drying out farms, and every time he came out, he drank. And he never stopped drinking until Bill finally carried the message out to him, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Now, we go to the problem, and then we'll go to the solution. All right? So the problem, as Dr. Silkworth is going to lay it out, is we believe, doctors, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that this phenomenon of cravings is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form. at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Now, that right there is step one. Problem one. He just described it. He just described the powerlessness over that first drink, and then when he talks about their lost their self-confidence, the reliance on human thing, their problems, he's talking about unmanageability. My life's unmanageable. So step one is right there. That's the problem. Okay? And then solution one. Frothy emotion appeal seldom suffices. You know what frothy emotion appeal is? Please, honey, just don't drink anymore. Please, Dad, don't go to the liquor store. Please, Mom, please don't do that anymore. That's froth emotional appeal, you know? And for me, it never worked. It didn't work at all. Why don't you just quit drinking? Why don't you just go away, you know? And that's what happened in my case. She went away. The solution. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. That's solution one. That's step two. A power greater than ourselves. Let me see where I am here. Okay. Okay, drop down to the bottom. We're going to go to problem two. Bottom of that page, it says, men and women, and you're talking about chronic alcoholics here, talking about me. I'm not talking about Mr. Smith who can have one or two drinks and he gets tingly and he gets dizzy and he wants to go home and go to bed. When I have one or two drinks, I want to get up and go to the bar. I want to get up and go drive. I want to get up and go get a bottle because I don't want one or two drinks. I know for a fact that as my first drink was being poured towards the end of my drinking career, I was thinking of my second drink. Normal people don't do that. And it'll tell me in a minute that I'm an abnormal person as far as alcohol comes, and I agree. I am. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. This is problem two. The cessation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. That means that the other people drinking aren't getting injured. But I'm an alcoholic. I'm killing myself. And I still can't not do it. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. All right, Dr. Silkworth is talking about a psychic change. Bill Wilson calls it a spiritual experience. It's the same thing. Okay? It's the exact same thing. And unless you experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of recovery. And then we go from the problem to a solution. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once this psychic change, spiritual experience, has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Now, this is Dr. Silkworth. He's talking about requirements, must, and rules. You know what the rules are? 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what he's talking about. To follow a few simple rules. Now, okay, we'll just carry on. Men have cried after me in sincere and despairing appeal, Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop. But I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives it all, gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Okay? Something more than human power. Well, that's what we're looking for. He goes on in the next paragraph to say, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or a business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to that date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that important appointment was never met. These men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. All right. When we talk about the allergy, everybody here knows about allergy. It's an abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance, right? And sometimes I use an analogy I don't have a lot of allergies. I don't know of any, but my doctor says I am allergic to pollen and my eyes swell, and I don't believe it. but it's probably true because my eyes swell. But it's an abnormal reaction. So, you know, you eat strawberries. Let's use strawberries. You eat green beans. You're allergic to green beans. Your mouth swells up. You get a rash. You know, I'm allergic to alcohol. And my allergy, what happens is it kicks off the phenomenon of craving. And it says to me, you need more alcohol. And you need more alcohol until I'm either in jail. You know, I don't break out in hives. I don't break out in rash. I break out in handcuffs. That's what I like to say. You know, you're either in jail or your body physically shuts itself down to prevent you from poisoning yourself. And that's what's called a blackout. When you pass out or blackout, your body is physically trying to stop you from killing it. And that's exactly what it is. Now, that is the definition of the allergy. The obsession that he's talking about is a thought or an idea that overrides all contrary thoughts or idea. Okay, an obsession is an idea that overrides everything else you know. So you know, I know, that if I drink, I'm going to keep drinking and I'm going to get drunk and I'm probably going to hurt somebody. But when I was in my active alcoholism, that obsession was so strong that it overrode all those other thoughts that this is not going to be a good idea. You are going to hurt somebody today. Don't do it. But my mind would say, it's going to be different. It's going to be different this time. I can take one drink this time, and it's going to be different. And you know what? It was never different. It was always the same result, which was not pretty. We're going on XXX, that's page 30. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. They kill themselves. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. But he's going to list five right here. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over remorseful and make many resolutions, but they never make a decision. And when we get to the third step, that's when we're first going to be asked to make a decision. Number two, there are types of men who are unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. When you change your environment, what do we call that? We call it trying to be geographically cured. I'm going to move to Dothan, and I'm going to stay sober. Well, I take an obsessive, allergic alcoholic, chronic alcoholic to Dothan. I'm not staying sober. I'm finding the nearest liquor store. So me moving somewhere is not going to change anything at all. I have to do something about my condition. There are the type who will always believe that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. We'll read later on about a guy named Fred who didn't drink for 25 years. He retired, Out comes the slippers, out comes the bottle, and within 4 years, a rich man died because he didn't do anything. He thought that, you know, I didn't drink for 25 years, I can take a drink. He was an alcoholic of my variety. There are the manic depressive type, who is, perhaps, the least understood by friends, and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Now, the manic depressive probably wants the whole book written about him, if you know manic depressives like I do. And then, here's the one I described as me, you know. Then there are the types that are entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, and friendly people. And there I am. You know, I am a able, intelligent, and friendly person until you put that first drop of alcohol in me and I become somebody else entirely, you know. All these and many others have one symptom in common. All these and many others have but one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be a manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. And here's the thing that scares a lot of people when they first come in, this next sentence. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Well, that's going to meetings and not drinking, okay? And I can tell you, meeting makers do not make it. Just not drinking and going to meetings, you will die of untreated alcoholism. If you don't do something to change the way you're living, if you don't find some, if you're a chronic alcoholic like me and you don't find some way to change my way of living, not just going to meetings and not drinking, I've got to have something greater than that that keeps and sustains my sobriety. And that's what I'm going to find later on in the book. But I don't have a chance of finding anything later on in the book if I'm drinking. I can tell you those 3.5 years that I went in and out of the program, I was never in, but I went in and out of meetings, I would go home sometimes from a meeting, pick up a bottle, pour a drink, and be sitting here reading this book while I'm drinking. And then I'd have to read the page again because I couldn't understand what they meant. And then I'd take another drink and I'd read the page, and by then I was drunk and I put the book down and it was a good coaster for a while. One of my big books has a whole bunch of circles on the top of it. And I've got many big books right now. This immediately precipitates into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. Now, he's writing this back in 1938, because this is right when the book's being written. And there was no cure for alcoholism in 1938. This is 2013. There is no cure for alcoholism today. I don't care about that guy in California who says he's got a pill that'll make it. I don't believe it. There is no cure for alcoholism. We can get well from a hopeless state of mind and body. We can recover, but we don't get cured. I just want to make that clear to everybody that we don't get cured. The book tells us later on that all we have is a daily reprieve based on our spiritual condition. So, now last week we talked about the guy who went over and spent a year with Dr. Carl Jung, Roland Hazard. He went an entire year without drinking. When he left Dr. Jung in Switzerland and he was making his way back to England to get on a boat, he was drunk. And later on we're going to read where he comes back into the book in a paragraph in Bill's story. And the doctor is going to give him an idea, but he can't give him a solution because the doctor can't give him a spiritual remedy, and that is what it's going to take, and that's going to be on page 26 when we get to that. Now, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I stop drinking. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I mean, I need my Baba, You know, I mean, that's the easiest way for me to say it to you. You have children. I need my Baba, you know, if I don't have something to fill it. And we talk about having this hole in our, inside of us when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if we don't fill that hole with something, we're probably going to go back to drink. We're probably going to want that instant relief that we get from taking one or two drinks. But then I know I can't take one or two drinks. I'm not going to take one or two drinks. I'm off to the races, and I don't know if I'm ever coming back. And I wasn't sure when I got back the last time that I was going to stay, but something happened. I had something happen to me. So if stopping drinking was the only thing that I needed to do, and my life was wonderful, I would stop drinking. My life would be wonderful. But my life's not wonderful when I stop drinking. My life is restless, irritable, and discontent until I find a solution for why I feel that way. And really and truly, what it is I don't deal with life. I didn't, for over 30 years, deal with life with life's terms. I dealt with life and the ups and downs by pouring alcohol on it. That's why I drank, because I couldn't stand being in reality. And I do not have the experience of going to a detox center. I do not have the experience of going into rehab. Okay, I am so glad there are detox centers. I'm so glad there are rehab centers. But almost every one of them, when you leave, tells you to get a sponsor and go to AA. You know, what they have done is separated you from alcohol for that period of time to defog your mind, and then they send you home hoping that you'll continue your recovery based on what they've either taught you or what they're telling you as you're going out the door, that you need to go get a sponsor and you need to work some steps. And then you get out the door. Most of my friends who've been to rehab have been more than once, and they said, you know, all they were doing was planning a drunk while they were sitting in rehab. They were thinking about it. They were obsessing about it because they had the mind of a chronic alcoholic. So by the time alcohol is doing something to me way down the line, okay, after I start drinking, that is by the time that alcohol is my solution, you know, to my problems. That's why I drink. My ability to deal with conflict and negative emotions have eroded to the point that sustained reality is simply unbearable, and that's why I have this dilemma. I can't stay sober because of reality. It's unbearable. Nor can I continue to drink because it's killing me and I'm dying. So I've got this problem. I've got to find a solution that fills that hole. It talks about the ease and comfort and relief. And the reason they talk about that is because alcoholics like me, I don't remember what alcohol did to me. You know, all I remember is what it was doing for me. It was making me not have to live in reality. No matter how bad I felt, no matter what I did, it just took me out of reality. And reality is not a bad thing. I mean, I have had great times sober. I've been bankrupt sober. I've lost people. I've seen people get well. You know, ups and downs. Life. It's just life. But for so many years, I drank life until the point where I couldn't not drink. And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. When you take away the ease and comfort at first from an alcoholic, if you're like me, you know, you're going to be restless, irritable, and discontent. Now, if you go into an AA meeting for your first time or your first week, and you just have detoxed, or you just came into an AA meeting like me, and you're dying, and you're sitting there looking at all these people laughing and having fun and having a great life, and you're like, nah, they're really drinking on the side, and then they're coming to meetings, you know. No, they're not. No, they're not. They have found a way to deal with reality without killing themselves, and that's what I had to do. I had to find something to fill that hole in my gut. Now, he just walked us through a drinking spree. You know, after they succumb to the desire again, step one, the first drink comes from the mind, the obsession, and the phenomenon of craving develops. Then the allergy takes over. As important as it is to understand that the allergy of the body, my real problem, the book is going to tell me, centers in my mind rather than my body. I can never change the allergy, but if I never put the first drink in, the allergy never develops. So, even though I didn't try, when it talks about more about alcoholism, countless vain attempts to attempt to drink like other people, I was different. I wasn't an alcoholic. You know, I drank every day. I drank for the effect produced by alcohol. I drank for over 30 years. But because I got up every morning, I didn't have the jitters, I went to work, I made a good living, I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. Until late-stage alcoholism started doing things to me that I couldn't explain and I couldn't control. And when I walked into an AA meeting, my first AA meeting, and somebody said, well, just don't drink today and come back tomorrow. And when I came back the second day, I realized, I can't do it. I can't do this. And it was 27 days of going to a meeting every day, swearing I was not going to drink that night. And by 7 o'clock that night, I was blacked out. And I swore I wasn't going to do it. I prayed, but I wasn't doing anything else. I wasn't doing any action to try to keep me sober. Okay, he told us what we were going to have to do. I forgot to tell everybody to turn off their cell phones, didn't I? Okay, that's all right. He tells us what we have to do. We have to have an entire psychic change. We have to have a spiritual experience. And so on top of page XXI, 31, it says, what is the solution? And he says, perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. Although 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope, hopelessness. Following the elimination of alcohol, drying him out, and finding that there was no permanent brain injury, he accepted the plan outlined in this book. He accepted the plan outlined in the book. Now, he followed the directions. He followed the specific instructions. He followed the path thoroughly. And a year later, he called upon him to see him, and I experienced a very strange sensation. This is Dr. Silk, we're still. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there was all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-confidence and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. That's one. And then he thinks of another guy that came to him. And he says, when I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and decided his situation was hopeless. He had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment was a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have willpower, my willpower, to resist the impulse to drink. You know, I've got tremendous willpower. And there are people that say, well, alcoholics are weak-willed people. We are not weak-willed people. We are strong people. I mean, we will knock over mountains to get a drink. You can't tell me I'm weak-willed. I was sick, and that's what he's explaining to me. I was sick. I had an obsessive mind, and I had an allergy a physical allergy. His allergic problem was so complex, that's the bottom of the page, and his depression was so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, spiritual awakening. And we doubted if even that would have any effect. Alright? However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He's not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he's a fine specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. Now, willpower and frothy emotional appeal didn't work for me. The 12 steps are designed to get rid of my conflict, tension, anxiety, guilt, remorse, all those things. That's exactly what they're for. It's to give me a course of action that I can use to be free of negative emotions and allow me to be happy, joyous, and free, like it says in the book. Alright, now that we understand what to expect from a psychic change, they're going to tell me for the second time what won't work. Human power, willpower, he just said. You know, unless you can tell me that my willpower will keep me from a drink, it's a waste of time. But what he did was he got sold on the idea that was contained in this book, and then he never drank again. Now, this to me is pretty important because it's the last sentence of Dr. Silkworth's thing. And it says, I earnestly advise every alcoholic. Now remember, this book was being mailed to alcoholics. In 1939, when the book was published, this was an original 12-step call. People would write to GSO or the Alcoholic Foundation, whatever it was called at that time, and they would send in $3.50, and they would send them a book, and this was what they had to get sober. There weren't meetings. There weren't people to sponsor anybody. There was 40 people when they started thinking about the idea to write the book. There was about 84, 85, first 100, when they wrote the book. And so there weren't a lot of places to go get recovery through this program. You got the book mailed to you, you read the book from beginning to end, and you implemented those steps into your life, and you could recover. Nowadays, it takes meetings for a lot of people. It takes hearing something over and over from different people before I understand it. It takes meetings for me to find other people to work with, which is what the 12-step tells me to do. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. And that's exactly what we're getting ready to get into in a few minutes. That is the solution right there. Now, I just want to run through a couple of things that we're going to get into in a few minutes, but these are, you know, they're called founding moments of the Big Book. One, it's when Roland Hazard meets Dr. Carl Jung, and we're going to read about him on page 26-27. And what Jung told Roland, and we'll read it again, is you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. And it goes on, Roland felt that the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. When Bill W. meets with Dr. Silkworth at Towns Hospital, and we're getting right into that in a minute, in 6 or 7, he shares the details of a chronic alcoholic's illness in detail. Bill describes his bottom on page 6, the remorse, horror, and hopelessness, and then he hits his bottom and he has his ego deflation at depth. A little bit further on in 8, 9, and 10, Bill meets with Ebbie Thatcher in November of 1934, and Bill talks about, he was sober, I was amazed. And that's the first record in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous of one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic who hit bottom. And it takes Bill about another month for him to actually get it. He has one more visit to the hospital. Bill expands on Ebbie's spiritual experience in meetings with Dr. Sam Schumacher. He was with the Oxford Group. He was the American director of the Oxford Group, who assisted Bill in the formation of the 12 steps of AA. And then we're going to find that when Bill W., 12 Steps Dr. Bob, in Akron, Ohio, in 1935, they both stayed sober for the rest of their life. And Bill said of Dr. Bob, the man did not fully realize what it meant to be an alcoholic, and he was a medical doctor. One alcoholic sharing a spiritual experience with another alcoholic who is bottomed out or has deflation at depth. And that's going to be pretty much it. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a couple things and we'll take a 10-minute break. The physical addiction, when Dr. Silk was sharing it with Bill, we believe, as so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. And it's limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. They, chronic alcoholics, are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can experience this ease, a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks that they've seen others taking with impunity. And then the phenomenon of craving, that physical craving, develops. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance on human things, their problems pile up on them and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. So what that's telling me is, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And it'll say that in the book here in a little while too. And it tells me, you know, why I drink. Essentially because I like the effect produced by alcohol. And my denial. The cessation is so elusive that while I admit it's killing me, it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. So, you know, that's really the highlight of Dr. Silkworth. And really, without him explaining what he had seen and what he had worked with through all those years, and with Bill three different times in the hospital, that he realized that it was going to take something greater than the medical profession could provide. And he wasn't sure what it was. And in a few minutes we'll read Bill's story, and we'll read where Ebby comes back into his life. Ebby's now going to the Oxford group. He's sober, and he'll be carrying a message to Bill somewhere in the next few pages. So why don't we do this? Why don't we take a 10-minute break? And then we'll come back and we'll start on Bill's story.